Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Show Me the Meaning Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning!
Introducing Nicolas Cage Month here at Wisecrack. We decided that we are going to do a month long. So right now it's the middle of January until the middle of February. We will be covering Nicolas Cage movies on our podcast. And you might be wondering, why are you doing that? And the answer is because that's just what we need in our life right now. Plus, we've got a great Nicolas Cage video coming out on Saturday that we're really excited about. But anyway,
I'm pumped. I can't
wait. We're all pumped. Welcome to Show Me the Meaning. Let me introduce the crew that we got today. We got Jacob.
Hello, hello.
We got Alec.
Hey.
And we got Austin.
Yo.
And today we're talking about the 1989 movie Vampire's Kiss, directed by Robert Bierman, starring Nicolas Cage and Maria Conchita Alonso. As always, let's go around and get some first impressions. Now, I know what Alec thinks about this movie. I know that Austin had not seen it before. I know Jacob had not seen it before. So I'm kind of curious as to what they thought about it when they ultimately sat down to watch it. Let's start with...
Hold on. I got to get some sound effects here. Let's start with...
Let's start with Alec.
I saw this movie for the first time 2 weeks ago. A++. It is so fucking good. That's all I have to say.
Beautiful.
Nice.
Beautiful.
Simple.
All right. Jacob, what did you think of the movie? So, I mean, you've been I've hyped it to you for so long.
You have. I feel like I was I got the unfair advantage of knowing what our video is going to be on Saturday.
Yeah.
Which changed my life. So get ready, everybody. It's going to be a great fucking video. But it completely like colored the way I was going to look at the movie. I had seen the clips before, and I had seen also your presentation at the Halloween show about you kind of made thesis statement that it's like the scariest movie of all time. So I had like really good information going into the movie, and so I loved it. I gave it like maybe an A- or A+. I mean, I loved it. I had a really good viewing. It was great.
Okay, awesome. Austin, what about you? You hadn't even heard of this movie before we said we were going to do this.
No, man. It's funny because, you know, the meme of him with his eyes looking all crazy and weird when he's talking to Maria Alonso is kind of famous and known. And so when I saw it, I was like, oh, that's what this is from. Okay. I mean, I feel like this is a film that is non-quantifiable. I feel like anything I say about it is going to undershoot what this film actually did to me. I laughed so hard during this film. And I don't mean that I necessarily laughed because it was like punchline and joke, but just because it was so unique and it made me feel stuff. And I think it's actually really provocative and thought-provoking. There's like some really cool psychoanalytic, like weird shit going on, you know, narcissism and, you know, desire and repression and, you know, like masculinity not getting the object of its sexual desire and things like that. But beyond all that, like, this movie's batshit crazy and I think I love it.
Yeah, dude. We got a whole positive family here. I'm actually great to hear. It's great to hear that. You know, for me,
I just love
every
it.
Once in a while, a movie comes along and makes you question.
This sounds like a Big Lebowski. Every now and then, once in a while,
There comes a movie that makes you question what it means to be a good movie.
Yes, exactly.
It redefines it.
When you think you know what separates a good movie from a bad movie, a movie like this comes into your life, and you just don't really know what to do. And that's how this movie, first of all, I saw this movie once years ago with Ryan, actually. I remember, like, Ryan and I had lived out here for like a year, and I guess he was aware that this was the movie that the meme came from, so he's like, we got to watch it, and we were both beside ourselves laughing our asses off. We loved the shit out of that movie. And not only that, but I think recently we had watched American Psycho, and I was like, oh, wow. This movie's actually a way better American Psycho than American Psycho.
This seems like the movie that should become a yearly tradition. Like, you brew a big batch of beer, you make a unique wine, you crack open the vintage, and then you share it with your friends and you watch this. Like, that's how I want to live the rest of my life.
If I may be overly wanky, I think this movie is understudied.
It's so good.
You know what?
Because it's...
I agree. I tried to Google, like, Vampire's Kiss and psychoanalysis, Vampire's Kiss and philosophy, Vampire's Kiss and Freud and Lacan, and all these terms that I thought for sure would bring some sort of results, and I got like blanked. I mean, I got a couple of articles and things like that, but nothing really substantive.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. If you listen to the director's commentary, and I listen to snippets of it because parts of it are on YouTube, it definitely seems like the director, Nicolas Cage, were just like, yeah, man, we were just fucking around. We didn't know what the fuck we were doing. Like, we kind of just didn't care. And I get that, and I know that it maybe seems a little bit ridiculous to try to think critically about a movie in which the creators clearly at least didn't put that much thought into it.
I think that's a little – that's like a little wrong. I think it's a mixture of okay. They were very sort of like loose about it. Like in one way they didn't care, but in another way – Nicolas Cage was like, I've never put so much effort into a role as I put into this one. But at the same time,
oh, awesome.
There was like a kind of just sort of freestyling about it, and it was very chaotic. So I think it's a little bit of the mixture of the two. It's the not caring and hyper caring at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah, cuz he seems like he hyper studied his performance. He was incredibly focused on what he was going to, you know, how he was going to deliver every single line and every gesture.
Yeah.
And but like that alongside kind of the craziness and the shenanigans of the set, which seems like it was kind of nuts and
right. And you know, a lot of we love to interpret text as if it sometimes kind of lives in a vacuum, but like if you just look at the movie as a text by itself without considering, you know, who cared how much or whatever, I think it's a fascinating film. Mm. And this was, I rewatched it again late 2018 with my girlfriend, and it was the best movie watching experience we had. We laughed our asses off. And yes, every time I watched it, I'm shocked with how thought-provoking and just interesting it is, whether on purpose or not. There's like perspective things going on in this film. There are, you know, sociological things going on in this film. And of course, Nicolas Cage is just amazingly fun to watch. So
I can imagine you in film school being like, this is the understudied movie.
Am I getting through to you?
Alpha! Yeah. So good.
Yeah, am I getting through to you, class, film school?
Oh, God. So thank you very much, Robert Bierman and Nicolas Cage, for this movie. I love it. It's, God, I mean, it's you know what it is? Like, and I've said this before, a lot of times when you study narrative like we do, a lot of times you kind of get numb to movies that are good for all the traditional reasons. Like, I recently saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and it was a good movie. It was just so precisely competent.
That's the word like, you've been using.
Competent. I mean, yeah.
It's well written.
Because it's that guy, Phil Lord or whatever, the guy who made the Lego movie. That guy knows how to write scripts with razor precision. Mm. And it feels like a good movie that hits all the beats, and it's just good. But it's good for reasons that are pretty easily identifiable. Not to say that makes it any less effective, but this movie is confounding it every turn. You're just like, what the fuck am I watching? But you're still laughing.
Because if you were to do like script doctoring or script analysis, you'd be like, it's his films this is are perfect and precise. This one would break
this
in every
one,
way.
This one is like, anyone would tell you, don't go into production and make this movie. Because by all traditional rules, this movie is going to be bad.
Yeah.
And it's not bad. It's amazing.
The greatest thing in the director's commentary is Bierman just various scenes being like, yeah, I don't know what I was thinking here. Like the mime scene. He's like, I don't know why I put those there.
I remember reading that.
And at the end where the vampire, Jessica Biel, kind of laughs after he dies. He's like, I don't know why I did that. Maybe I should have taken that out. But it all works in a very good way.
And just for people who are listening, it's not Jessica Biel, but Jennifer Beals. But if it were Jessica Jennifer Beals, Biel, that would be pretty awesome, too.
Sorry.
Interesting. All right, guys, let's go into a recap. So Playboy literary executive Peter Lowe finds himself aroused when a bat interrupts one of his one-night stands. The next night, he brings home Rachel, who, in the throes of passion, bares her vampire teeth and bites him. The next morning, she's gone, but Peter seems to think she's still there. Meanwhile, at the office, Peter tasks his assistant, Alva, to find a particular contract lost in a sea of paperwork. When she can't find it, he becomes increasingly frustrated. Peter's behavior becomes more and more erratic as Rachel visits his apartment every night and dominates him. When Alva continues not to produce the contract he requested, he becomes downright abusive, chasing her into the bathroom, visiting her at home when she's sick, and eventually raping her. Alva's brother vows revenge when Peter descends deeper and deeper into madness or continues turning into a vampire, depending on how you interpret it. He stampedes up and down the street, shouting he's a vampire, he buys fake vampire teeth, eats a live pigeon, and kills a woman at a club where Rachel appears and breaks up with him. He then sees her with a new man and accosts her, but she only vaguely remembers him. Peter fantasizes about ending therapy in favor of the real thing that can make him happy, true love. The doctor pairs him up with her other patient, Sharon, who is perfect in every respect, but by the time they get back to his apartment, he's already sick of her. Peter tries to kill himself with a wooden stake, and when Alva's brother shows up at his apartment, he shoves it in hard enough to kill him. End of movie.
Hi, Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
All right, guys. So the first thing I want to ask about this movie is, what is it about? What happens in this movie? So I want to go around and see what do you guys take away from this? Let's start with Alec.
You know, it's weird. The only thing I've ever seen it described as from Nicolas Cage and the director is a story about loneliness and the city driving a man crazy. And I obviously don't disagree with that, but I think you agree with me here, and I probably got this idea from you. On one end, it's about how the rich live parasitically off the working class. And in another way, it's about sort of people's, like this rich guy's standard, like his relationship with women being very like toxic and destroying him from within. So I think the most telling example of this is at the end, he finds the girl of the dreams, but still by the end of the walk home, I think he's calling her a cunt.
third time.
But it's like, he's so poisoned internally. He'll never find like true happiness from women, which, you know, his relationship to women is sort of shown throughout the movie. So I think it's about those two things.
I think I would say the same. My question is, do you guys have any idea of what literally happens with Rachel? Like, if we're to believe that the whole vampire thing is just him going crazy, and then at the end he actually sees Rachel in the club and she kind of remembers him, but obviously not all the vampire stuff had happened. So what actually happened between them?
I think he slept with her and then imagined, like in real life, and then imagined the rest.
Okay.
Do you think the first time that they met, when he asked her if she got the joke, that was like the first night that they had met, that they slept together then, and then the rest is all fabrication?
Maybe. I was also wondering.
Or do you think it's like prior to that?
I thought it was just a pickup line.
Yeah, I think they probably met that night. My thing was, I didn't know if I was, is this a movie about a guy who kind of can't get over a girl who didn't want him? Like, did he bring her home that night? They had a one night stand and he gets infected with like true love and he really wants her, but she didn't want him or something. And that's what drives him crazy. That's what maybe
it's
I was interpreting.
Ambiguous,
like,
yeah.
Because we've seen that he's had a lot of one night stands, and then, but then this one changes things, really shatters his psyche. Or either that, or it was the bat in the previous one night stand. I don't, what do you guys have anything to interpret about the bat? What's the significance of the bat arousing him?
Well, I mean, it has something to do with fear and releasing something. Why is it specifically a bat? I mean, it probably has something to do with a combination, one of fear mixed with sexual arousal, but also attaching that to kind of like the mythos of Nosferatu and things like that, that are all kind of filtered in there. And then if you tap that onto or attach that onto the idea of the dissatisfaction that comes with being a part of like the extractive class, right? That you're always chasing something more. I think all of that is kind of circling around that. So, I mean, I think it kind of has something to do with his dissatisfaction with being somebody who is supposed to be in a position of the satisfied. And it all kind of like, it's the return of the repressed. All of that's been repressed, and it comes out in that moment of fear. It could be embarrassment, vulnerability. It could be something along those lines. Like maybe there's like he couldn't actually satisfy a woman, and so there's an insecurity that comes back. I mean, I know I'm doing like a deep read, and that's not really there, but it has something to do with like a return of the repressed, right? And for some reason, that frightens him in his state of arousal, and it arouses him even more, and it spirals him down into this mania where he can only narcissistically project his own object of his desire, which is really just himself, right? Because he's talking to himself, especially at the end when he's got like the perfect woman who he ends up hating again after 10 minutes, right? And that's how the film starts too. When he's talking with his psychiatrist, he says, yeah, or she says, oh, but you wanted her the night before. But as soon as I woke up in the morning, I was dressed and I was in my clothes and I just wanted to get rid of her. So it's this idea of chasing the object of desire. And then once you get it, you don't want it anymore. It's that famous madman line. It's like Don Draper says, what's happiness? He's like, you don't want to be happy. What's happiness? Happiness is just a moment before you need more happiness. And it's that sort of thing.
Yeah. See, it's these kind of things. It's like, yeah, this movie, on an initial viewing, it might be ridiculous to focus on anything other than Nick Cage's wild performance. But it does play with some very interesting ideas mm-hmm. and themes. I mean, for people like us, it's the Nick Cage performance only baits us into wanting to look deeper into those things. So, yeah, that's why this movie is so fun and so fascinating. You know, one thing that I hadn't taken into consideration that kind of puts the tone of this movie into a bit of context is that this movie came out in 1989.
88, I think.
I think it was 80. Well, either one. It was the end of the 80s, and the 80s had so many vampire movies. So there was The Lost Boys, Fright Night, Near Dark, The Monster Squad, Once Bitten, Vamp, My Best Friend is a Vampire, Life Force, Vampire Hunter D. It almost makes sense to see that like they're kind of taking the piss out of the vampire genre that had kind of dominated a decade toward the end of the decade, and maybe that's kind of what they were going for with going so over the top. But anyway, I interrupted you, Alec. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to, I don't have any answers here, but I do think it's interesting, Nosferatu especially, which they watch in the movie, there's just this common conflation with vampires and like eroticism and seduction, and Nosferatu preys off of, you know, peasant women and assaults them and all these crazy things. But in the case of Nick Cage, his fantasy is being dominated, not him dominating women, although that's what he does to Alva, but initially it's him being dominated by Rachel, the female vampire. I don't really know what that means, but it's just there.
Mm-hmm. It's a touch of danger too, right? Like he's it seems like almost he's bored with this sort of play he does every weekend mm-hmm. when he has the women and he takes them home and he does his thing with them, and all of a sudden this bat is like the touch of danger. It's something new and different. He's aroused by that. And then he kind of descends into this whole madness and this different direction for himself until ultimately he's kind of right back where he started. Right.
I mean, there could be a good like queer theory reading of this, right? That it's like the idea of the inversion of masculinity is he thinks that he wants to be the penetrator, but he can never actually get satisfied that way. But it's only when he's submissive that kind of happens, and that there's like, I bet there is like a really interesting sort of like reading on this, like some sort of Lee Edelman style reading or something, you know?
Alva's brother.
Yeah, man.
Does
Academia, get on this movie, man. You guys are slacking.
I know.
All right, so let's talk about.
That's all you have to do.
All right, so let's talk about Cage's performance. Let's get to the good stuff.
Oh, man.
So I just want to start this by saying that one of my favorite things about this movie is that you would think that if you're a director and you're making this vampire movie and you've just finished production and you're looking at your footage and you see that Nick Cage has gone off of his fucking rocker, wouldn't you, at least especially if you had a studio on your ass, you would probably say, all right, now we got to kind of make the tone of the movie fit his performance so that it seems like we're all on the same page here and it was intentional, but they don't do that. The opening typography and music are unironic, not bombastic. It's atmospheric as if it's setting up a straight-up eerie horror film, not over the top at all. And it's that dissonance, that sense that this movie formally is taking itself seriously while Nick Cage is going nuts, really creates a very interesting tone that you can't put your finger on because it's – and that made it just so captivating for me to watch.
It creates attention. It reminds me of like Lynch, where like something's off and you can't quite put your finger on it because it feels eerie that everyone's taking him so seriously, yet it's quite dissonant.
Yeah, but it creates something really unique.
It's interesting this film is billed as like a dark or black comedy. It was marketed that way. The director refers to it that way. But when I was watching it the first time, I did not even think of it that way. I mean, I was laughing, but I didn't know I was supposed to be laughing. But it is intentional to a certain extent.
I didn't really watch it as a comedy. I think I watched it. I think I went into it kind of really seriously and with like grave intentions to see what it was. And there were parts, of course, I'm just laughing like boo hoo hoo. There's some parts that you just can't help but like, you know, bite your lip. But I think it can be enjoyed that way too. I mean, it can't, like, his performance is good. It's really good, even though it is over the top. Or I guess he doesn't like, I think in the commentary, he's like, you can't really say over the top, but it's extreme. It's absurd. You know, it's an absurd performance, yet it I don't know, for me, it worked. The same way for Mandy, like, that whole scene of the screaming, like, it's convincing.
Well, they say at one point, when he's, you know, wearing his funky sunglasses and he's walking through the office, and they're like, he's just so eccentric. And I was almost like, is that breaking the fourth wall? You know? It's kind of like, yeah.
Well, there's another...
Well, in a way, yeah, I guess they are, they're seeing his shenanigans. They're seeing it the way the audience does. I think maybe you're right, but...
There's a part in the movie that is more to what Austin is saying here that I hadn't noticed in previous viewings, when he's, like, freaking out in the bathroom. I think maybe this is when he doesn't see his reflection or something like that. Mm. And then there's a guy who's, like, in
taking
the
a shit.
He's taking a shit, and he says, quit with the acting lessons. It's like, how self-aware were they about the kind of, like, the fact that it feels like acting, or how could you not be reminded that you're watching an actor acting with such a performance?
Right.
Or something.
Well, in the
like
commentary
that.
Article that you sent across, which is that director and actor commentary, he says that his theater teacher, like, that, am I getting through to you, Alva? Mm. Like, that's based on, it's inspired by his drama teacher, who's like, you're not good enough or bad enough to be acting that way, to be like acting like an asshole. And
we've talked about this before, Jared, but I think this is a good time to get into the whole anti-hero thing. I've been sort of complaining for months now that a lot of anti-heroes, people you should emulate, like Walter, the directors and the creators of the thing don't want you to emulate these people. Walter White, Patrick Bateman, all these shitty human beings, but nonetheless, you see people trying to emulate Rick Sanchez or Walter White. They'll put a Punisher sticker on their car, shit like that. And I think the problem is that, it, you know, good writing often involves creating empathy for people. And I'm not saying empathy for anti-heroes is bad, but it leads to a weird thing. But my argument is that Nick Cage's performance is so alienating and so over the top and so unbelievable that, to your point, Jared, it's like American Psycho, but better, because there's no world where you'd be like, oh, I want to be like him. And the best thing about the commentary is that the director kind of confirms this. He says, you know, I wanted to do Nick Cage kind of anti-naturalist, but Alva, I thought it was weird that Alva and everyone else is acting naturalistically, but Nick Cage is not. But he says he did that intentionally, because when Alva's acting, you know, like a real human being, you sympathize with her and you are sort of rooting for her. Whereas Nick Cage, who's acting like a complete monster, you're like, oh no, not like that. And just little things like in the rape scene where he does that terrible licking thing. It's just so fucking, like, offensive and horrifying, but, like, in the exact way it's supposed to be. And I wonder, my question is, like, what would other things look like if Nick Cage was the like, what would Howard Beale played by Nicolas Cage look like? What would Walter White look played by Nicolas Cage look like?
Well, it's not only the performance. So first of all, yes, I agree, Alec. And I think that's one of the most brilliant things about the movie is that exactly. But I think that this is also done on a formal level. So, for example, usually – first – okay, so what I was going to say before is I find it's ballsy that you would have a film which is probably only – this movie was probably only able to be made because Nick Cage was starring in it, and he was kind of on the upswing after Moonstruck after this movie. And to even create a movie in which your star, your selling point, is not to be identified with is something that, you know, you actually make it so that you identify with everyone else except that is ballsy. That's something that would never happen today, at least if significant money was being put behind the movie. But my point is, we also see this formally in that how the filmmaker puts this distance between us and Nicolas Cage. For example, we don't really – I mean, kind of – sometimes we see his mania as if we're looking through his perspective, but other times we don't. So, for example, he thinks his reflection in the mirror has disappeared, but we see it. and we don't really experience his breakdown from his point of view. We're on the outside. Right. So there's the other parts where he offers coffee to what he thinks is Rachel, but we see as nothing. And then he invites Rachel to get into the shower with him at one point, but there's no one there. And so – normally, if you were doing a movie like Fight Club or the big 1999, Russell Crowe, I See People, mathematician movie.
Oh, Beautiful Mind.
Beautiful Mind. Yeah, we always are seeing their mania from their perspective, and it's supposed to draw
internally
empathy and sympathy to the protagonist. But in this, that doesn't really
It's always
happen.
Undercut. Yeah, every time we see his where he's headed.
We're on the outside saying, this guy's crazy.
Yeah, and we're seeing his descent.
Yeah, I think that's really, really interesting.
I want to see if
See, I didn't
Cage.
Know for a second, though. Like, I was wondering at first if she really was a vampire and she just was,
too.
Like, invisible. And then like, somehow it didn't hit me until later that she wasn't there all along. And then I actually started thinking the whole thing, like, is the psychiatrist, the scenes with the psychiatrist, were all of those imagined? Even the opening scenes, that none of them were real, which means that when we're thrown into the story at the outset, we're already thrown into him in a state of hysteria or in a state of delusionment, where he's and then what does that mean? What's going on in those psychiatrist's scenes? And what does that tell us about him from the outset as he's kind of like dealing with his own psychological maladies?
I mean, this probably sounds so douchey, but I really think it's up to interpretation.
And that's what he said, right? That's what Nick Cage said. But here's the thing that I think is interesting. So you know his accent, right? Which is like,
very continental. I was
going to
say, I should do the whole podcast that way. I would sound like Zoolander. I could do the entire podcast sounding very continental, like Mr. Lowe.
I mean, it's the weirdest fucking thing, man. When I first heard it, I was like, what is he doing?
What does he mean by continental also?
Continental, it just means sort of European, kind of hard to place, elusive life.
No, European people do not sound like that.
No,
say.
It's kind of like an American who's lived abroad too long.
Yeah.
Do you know people who sound like that?
No, of course not. I was just, the entire time I was just thinking, oh my God, the producers must be shitting bricks at the dailies watching thinking.
They did.
They were, I saw that. I read that afterward. I was like, they must have been losing themselves thinking, oh my God, the movie is ruined.
Well, that's why I thought, that's why it's amazing that the movie isn't like, you know, doesn't try to make more of a joke of it in post.
Oh.
You know, it's amazing that it survived in it, what I imagine is its original vision.
So the weird thing is I've like, actually heard people put on accents like that. And there's this one pastor in particular that I remember who was American. And I remember when I listened to him back in the day, when I would listen to like sermons of his or when I would listen to interviews, I was like, what is that accent? And it's just this like, it's this attempt at East Coast elitism, but it's kind of like this weird faux British inflection that gets kind of put in there. But it made me think, like, beyond the fact that Nick Cage is just eccentric and he's doing something wild with the character, it made me think it actually fits really well with the character, because the character, maybe he's not actually an elitist, or I'm sorry, maybe he's not actually an elite, but maybe he's an elitist in that he's always striving to be. I mean, he works in literary, like,
hey man, books were big business back then.
I
yeah,
mean,
back then,
in 88, it was a good business, baby.
I mean, maybe, but I was wondering that. I was like, but he's not a banker. He's not a Wall Street guy. He's not like yeah, you're right.
But he dresses that way. Yeah,
and he does have a nice apartment, and he does wear nice suits. But I was thinking maybe he feels inadequate. And so even putting on the accent works for the character because it's him trying to be even more than he actually is in the world.
He drops it at times.
Right.
Oh, does he? I didn't notice that.
I didn't notice it until Nick Cage was claiming he did, like, in the therapist office, which, like, it's Nicolas Cage put on that
most
accent,
extreme
which was emulating
there.
His
well,
father.
Like, who?
To, like,
I thought
show
it was
that
most extreme in the therapist.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's more to the point of, like, distancing yourself from the protagonist. Like, he's so affective, so douchey, so fake that, you know, there are no opportunities for the audience to really identify with him.
And then he's like able to get along with his bosses. I mean, he's that scene where he's laughing hysterically in the office.
Yeah. So that's
with all his bosses. I'm like, everyone else seems to be okay with him there, but he's laughing too hard. His accent's ridiculous. And he's like,
well, that's another thing about how the movie is very openly critical of kind of the old boys club, or, you know, like in a way this movie seems very modern if you look at it in today's context. When you're talking about like all these new conversations about power dynamics in the workplace, we see a guy, a boss, who's abusing his secretary, who's also a minority, and when Alva tells the boss about his misbehavior, which is very justified, they laugh it off in the most over-the-top manner. And then one of the guys, and by the way, you know, they're all just like suited old white guys. And it seems way ahead of its time, kind of pointing out and trivializing this abusive symmetry of power. And even at one point, one of the guys says, she actually asked me for a raise. Can you believe it? Yeah. And they just start laughing.
And her brother's also like, it's fine. The mother, obviously, it's fine. Everyone hates their boss. It's, just put up with it.
Look at the distinction between Nicolas Cage's apartment, which is nice, and then
her house,
Alva's house. Like, all the family lives together. She lives with her mother. She lives with her brother. They all have three jobs.
Away,
they have to commute far away. They all have three jobs between them, all living in one house.
Did you guys notice the Franz Kafka portrait behind his desk?
I didn't, but I heard about it, and I was like, oh, where is that?
That was the first thing I noticed. This thing, the whole movie is like the metamorphosis. You're just watching this man descend further and further and further into a creature.
The other thing, Jared, to your point, is that even that scene where he's in the bathroom and the guy yells about him, about his acting or whatever, doesn't he say, like, go back in the women's restroom, which is a reference to when he chased Alva in the bathroom? Like, it's so well known in The Office that
I'm just gonna
be annoyed with you but make a joke about you stalking someone in the women's bathroom.
I thought it was like him being performative and emotional, like, get out of here, go to the women's restroom. Like, well, it was again another pejorative.
The other great part about the old boys club is when he calls his client and he's like, look, Alva, I'm gonna have to do a whole
sing and dance to
make sure that this guy isn't angry. And then he gets her on the phone. I love just the look in his eyes. He's looking at
he's
Alva. And the other guy is just like so chill.
Kind.
He's like, I'm sure you and your girl have other things to do. And he's just like, yeah, okay, Frank.
Well, then I thought maybe he's gonna admit that nothing happened, and then all of a sudden he twists it, he inverts it. So it's like, it was like these three beats in that scene that are like, oh shit, he's gonna have to like perform, and then he's off the hook. He's admitting to her that he was off the hook, and then he's like, now, you know, he didn't even let me get a word in edgewise.
Right, yeah. He is so livid right now. And that's another
I have so many of these sounds on this soundboard. I have to play with these.
But another thing, I just when people think of yuppie executive culture where just a bunch of dudes in suits don't actually do any work and just hey, you son of a bitch, I'm calling you on the phone, give me $1 million deal, just our dads did back in the day. That's what you think of.
Yeah,
it's so funny.
And he's like, I'm gonna take the rest of the day off.
We never see him work.
No,
he's staring at his blotter. What is he saying when he's staring at it?
He's staring at what?
He's staring at his desk, the thing on his desk, and he's like chanting something, and I can't remember what it was.
Well, also, let's not forget that the whole thing that he's having Alva do is so trivial. Like, not only is that the only thing on his mind, but it's really just like, hey, one of our clients wants to frame one of his first sales. You know, it has nothing to do with business operations at the company. It's just a favor for a client, and that's all he has on his mind for the whole week.
I could think of a more horrible job if I wanted to, and you have to do it.
You have to,
or I'll fire you. Do you understand?
All right, so I think this is
way. There is like a weird power thing that's going on with that too. Remember when he says the alphabet in front of the psychiatrist, and he like forces that he has to finish it. He has to do it. There's this weird like narcissistic power thing. Do you have the clip of the alphabet? Because that would be amazing.
I do. Let me play it right now. Oh, yeah. Here it is.
It could be easier. It's all alphabetical. You just put it in the right file, according to alphabetical order. You know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z! Huh?
So the thing that's so interesting is that he has to finish, even at her protestations. And again, remember at the beginning, there's that other bit where he's saying time's up, I've got to go.
You know your ABCs.
And she's like, how come you always feel like you need to end the session? Is it because you can't allow me to do that? So again, these power dynamics are constant. And then he does the same thing. He has to have what's her name? Alva. He has to have her do this this meaningless task, but it's because it's a power thing. He has to be the one that's in control of everything. He's a narcissist. Like in the typical way that a psychologist would diagnose somebody, everybody else is his supply, and he's a narcissist feeding off of them.
All right, so what I was going to say is that we're talking kind of about class and power dynamics, which is an appropriate time to transition the conversation to vampires. We actually did a video 2 weeks ago on the new Netflix Castlevania show and talked about how in the original Bram Stoker book, class is a relevant theme in the book. And it's interesting how they have even brought that into this movie as well. There's a part in the movie where Nicolas Cage, I guess he's starting to turn or starting to lose his mind, depending on how you interpret it. And he's at a diner and he says, fucking Grease Hood. And then storms out. We already mentioned earlier about how Alva lives in a poor neighborhood and lives with her mom and her whole family. I also really like the part, it's very short, but Alva gives money to the beggar on the subway.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, she obviously doesn't have a lot. She doesn't have, you know, as much wealth as Peter, but she's still giving stuff away. And then I wanted to ask you guys, what do you guys think about the cab driver character? I really like this character. He's got a photo of him and his wife, and he says, there is love, and then there is work.
Yeah.
And the work is just for the love. And I think he's a really good contrast to Peter. Peter is the 100% careerist who can't find love because his career is his entire identity, whereas we have this cab driver guy who's just like, you know, yeah, I just do whatever minimum task I need to do to get back to my love, which is really what I anchor my identity in. I thought that was so cool.
I think it's interesting, sweet man. Just going off Austin's point about narcissism, is that in the final scene, Nick Cage wants his lover to reflect him. She should listen to classical music and be just like him, which is, I think, a tendency in like millennial culture to essentially like, oh, I need to find someone on Tinder who does like all the things I do and be exactly like me. Whereas like, it's not really fleshed out with the cab driver, but I think it's hinted to like, yeah, like he's just like a plain guy with a plain wife and like he loves her and like we're to assume it's healthy and not narcissistic and all these things. So like he comes back, the cab driver and his wife comes back later in his delusions as almost like taunting him or just like a reminder of like his so fucked up conception of love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like that. Yeah. And I wondered that. I wondered if that was going to almost be like the commentary that the film was making. That's like, all you need is love kind of thing. But then at the end, it totally destroys that. Because then you think that, oh, like this guy is, he himself is like incapable of it. Because even the kind of like perfect woman is basically just a reflection of himself, but in female form, you know? And I don't know. I don't know what it's saying. Like, I don't know if it's trying to say something bigger than that, or if it's just kind of like a funny little plot device, or if it's just consistent with the character. But maybe it is kind of trying to say that, you know, you do need a foil in order to really have true love.
Well, also, I think it's interesting that all the women that Nicolas Cage sleeps with are like super attractive. Not to be mean here, but like, you know, the cab driver's wife is not that attractive, but like he's much happier than Nick Cage. Like Nick Cage can sleep with as many beautiful women as he wants, but he'll still always be a miserable prick.
What'd you guys think about the subplot with the first woman that he brings home in the movie, the one who sees the bat and the one that he later bails on her at the art gallery and then he stands her up at the bar? I guess even maybe later that same night.
And then when she rejects him, that's what drives him into the fit of rage, which I think speaks to this whole rejection thing.
Right.
Which is a telltale like symptom of, I forget what they call it, with narcissism. But when you restrict the supply from them, when they can no longer have access to the thing that is the source of their energy that they're tapping into, they freak out. And they respond to this. I mean, I'm actually going through, not personally, but somebody very close to me is going through this with an ex that they've recently been with. And so she's been kind of like relaying all of this stuff to me. So it's like actually really fresh in my mind, but that's exactly what it is. It's you need that supply. And when you don't have it, you go into a narcissistic rage.
You need people's validation, even if you don't necessarily care about them or any of that stuff.
It just created further distance for me. Like it cements him as more and more of an asshole at that point.
Yeah.
Like at every turn, he's treating her so poorly that you're just, you know, you're ready to, yeah, you just, any empathy you might have had for him is now completely gone.
And she seems so fucking cool too. She's into art. She had a good sense of humor. She laughed off a fucking bat attacking them in the middle of the throngs of passion.
Great.
She seemed like a badass, man. I was like, man, this guy fucked up. And she's gorgeous. So it's like on top of all of that. Fuck.
Yeah, I know. And then also the thing, obviously, to bring up is Nosferatu. So the movie actually plays on the TV. He basically starts to physically emulate Nosferatu. So
he literally does at one point when he attacks the woman in the club.
Yeah, there's that. But also, like, when Alva comes to the door when she's finally found the contract and he opens the door and he's, like, hunched over and his hair is, like, slicked in a way that makes his head look more like Nosferatu. And I think that's probably where Cage's acting inspiration was derived from, because a little bit of a spoiler warning.
I know. I was going to get into our script, but I'm not touching
it. Yeah, so on Saturday, we talk – Saturday's video is about Nick Cage, and we talk a little bit about his acting inspiration. And just as a little taste of that, we won't go too deep into it, but he draws a lot from German Expressionism and kind of more bombastic movements and stuff like that. And Nosferatu is a essential piece of German Expressionism. So maybe it's even like, all right, I want to not only is it I'm taking inspiration from vampires of old, but literally I'm taking the method of acting of German Expressionist vampires and bringing it to a 1980s movie, which is definitely provides for something interesting, as we've seen.
I have another line I'm going to play here real quick.
Yeah.
Well, the fact is I did murder someone last night. I turned into a vampire. It's a long story.
I love how when he's talking with what's the woman's name at the end that is like the perfect woman?
Does she have any name?
Oh, no, she does. It's hold on. I think it's Sharon.
Sharon or something, yeah. So
is Sharon.
Yeah, and so, but I love how when he's complaining about her, the reason he starts complaining about her is because she won't get off the fact that he turned into a vampire, which again just shows his own sort of like insecurity and neurosis about this these delusions that he's having. Again, it's the return of the repressed. He's repressing it, but he can't hide it from himself that he's lying to himself, right? So even in his delusions have to remind him that he's full of shit. And that's what that is about. Really? You became a vampire? Why did you become a vampire? When did you become a vampire? For how long? And it's like, God damn it, stop nagging me. But that's really just himself.
By the way, Cody says in the comments that vegans are the real vampires.
Thanks, Cody.
Thank you, Cody.
Super cool.
Thank you, Cody. Hell yeah, that's my man right there. You know, to get all meta about this class thing.
Oh,
I'm excited.
That's right. In the director's commentary, they mentioned that a couple of the scenes when Nick Cage is going crazy at the end and he's basically walking the streets like a hobo, this film was so low budget that they just used a long angle lens, which basically means they could just put the camera very far away. And Nick Cage was just walking through the street with this wooden stake, freaking out. And those other people around him are not actors. They're not extras. Those are just real people walking the streets. And on a meta level, that's really interesting that, like, we basically have this literary executive turned hobo. And if you were trying to make a point about how distanced people are to people with problems or to people on the lower side of the economic spectrum, and we actually have that evident in front of us in just the way that the movie was produced.
They also mentioned in that commentary that one of the clubs, in the club where he meets Rachel, they had to, like, drag a dead body out of the club in the morning before they shot there. Because it said pre-Giuliani 1988 in New York City or 1987, it was rough.
When the film started, I was immediately transfixed on how New York was presented. New York was presented almost with a character of its own. It was almost like a background character that was there the whole time. And the portrayal of New York is a very particular portrayal of New York. Right? It's not the New York that's the city of dreams. If I can make it here, I'll make it anywhere. It's not Broadway. It's not that. It's a very dark, dreary, fog-laden New York that is violent and hostile and lonely. And I don't know if – I think I read something that, like, the director has made a couple of films about New York. Or maybe it was the writer. Maybe it was the writer. And they both kind of have a similar sort of take about New York. Oh, yeah, it was the writer because he did a Scorsese film. I don't remember which film it was, though. What is it?
Was it After Hours?
Yes, it was.
I'm just trying to think of. Oh, yes, okay,
it was.
There you go.
Yeah. And they both have like a sort of like dreary depiction of this city in a very particular way. And I found that to be really interesting because it sets like the background in which the story takes place.
Well, what's also great is that Robert Bierman talks about this, but earlier on in the therapist sessions, the city is often out of focus in the background. But as he gets more and more insane, the city, it comes into focus. I think it's like in Madison Square Park is what the building's overlooking. But at the end where he's having the conversation with himself to the wall and it cutting to them, he's standing like on the ledge, the park like in full focus. And the idea is that the city is in part what's driving him insane.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, very cool. Yeah,
there's a link to that article. Actually, I'll post that right
it's
now.
It's a great article. It's called like 57 Things We Learned from the Vampire's Kiss Commentary. And every single piece is so fucking amazing.
Yeah, it definitely seems like he's painting New York as the New York version of, or the Transylvania version of New York.
This was also, you know, this was in the 80s where like New York was still very gritty and very. And also there was a time where New York had, I don't even know, they were like mental hospitals and they were closed down and essentially all those people were left on the street and all those people now, that's why you see now a lot of homeless people on the street and they've since gone elsewhere or stayed homeless or a variety of other things. But Nick Cage is like, yeah, these are exactly like the people I would see around me. But even, you know, in my experiences in New York, like there's two people in my neighborhood who are exactly like this. They're not covered in blood and I'm pretty sure they're harmless, but like, they're always having a conversation with somebody else. Sometimes it's an argument, sometimes it's not. And I mean, one read is like, yeah, people are indifferent to them, but it's also a little bit of a survival strategy. Cause like if someone's arguing with a fantasy person, if you try to intervene in that, they might like punch you or bite you or a variety of other things.
I really like how there's a bit of vampire foreshadowing at the beginning of the movie. So at the opening shot, he's laying on the couch in a kind of coffin-esque way. And then when he picks up the first girl, he says to the cab, "Be off, my castle is but a few short blocks away." In his you do it in the continental voice. Be off, my castle's but a few
Blocks away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so he like speaks like an old count. Yes.
Jesus.
What a man. Be off with you. He sounds to me like it's like George Takei meets Zoolander.
Oh, nice.
Go away now. That's just fine. Oh, my.
You know what I also found interesting? We talked a bit about how this movie versus American Psycho, but also how that inaccessibility works into it, is you can't tell when Peter is being authentic and when he's not, especially when he goes to Alva's house with the soup. By the way, I just love that the soup
it's
is like
a powdery
it's
piece
the
of shit.
Shittiest thing ever.
Plus, I brought soup.
Yeah, and
the weakest gesture possible.
Yeah, even when he's authentic, we don't really know. So we're not sure whether he's putting up a front when he confronts Alva, and then when he does drop the front and says, "You're going to find that contract right fucking now," or whatever. It's a bit of a surprise, and I think, yeah, it's just, I mean, I can see why people. I think that it's a twofold thing. One, for nerds like us, it makes for an interesting film because we're not used to movies with that kind of perspective. But if for most traditional moviegoers, I think building this wall between you and the protagonist probably makes for a kind of, I don't want to say boring, but like it's probably easy to like lose interest.
Yeah, I was trying to explain this to a friend of mine. She was texting me and she's like, "Oh, what are you up to?" And I sent her like a photo of my screen as I was watching it. And I was like, "You know Nick Cage, right?" She's from Brazil. And she's like, "You know Nick," I was like, "You know Nick Cage, right?" She's like, "Of course I do." And so I tried to describe the film without like giving too much away. She's like, "Oh, is he the vampire?" And I'm like, sorta. I was like, "Well, there's kind of an inside joke in this film." And she said, "Well, what do you mean?" And I said, "Well, you know how he is kind of like considered to be this over the top kind of eccentric kind of person and character." I was like, "You have to watch the film, I think, with that in your mind to really get like an extra layer of entertainment out of it. Do you guys agree?"
Yeah, it's his performance
well,
that
now,
keeps you interested.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other thing, is that if you watch this movie in 2019, then it really is like you're watching a movie that basically justifies the meme that we know as Nicolas Cage, which is I wish that Robert Bierman and Nicolas Cage had done that director's commentary more recently.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that was like in the 90s or something like that, before there was ever the open-eyed meme or anything. Because now I was actually – who was I telling this to? I think I was telling it to Amanda, who wrote the Nicolas Cage episode on Saturday. If they put this movie on Netflix and just had the thumbnail be him with the eyes, it would get – like this movie would have a reawakening, you know, because it's actually on Amazon Prime and they use like the theatrical poster, which makes it look like a rom-com.
Right.
Bad idea. This movie, I really think, could have a reawakening and be...
It feels like such a cult classic. Like I said, it feels like the movie you roll up every year as you crack open your new brew or whatever. Like, you make something special, you get all your friends together, and then you watch this every year as a tradition. I'm like, that's how I'd want to live my life.
I've seen this movie so three good. Times, and I've had so much fun every single second of the movie. And I can't say that for a lot of films of 2018.
Yeah.
You know, there have been films that are perhaps technically better, but...
It's fun.
What's a good movie, you know?
Yeah. That's the theme of 2019.
What makes
a movie, Jared?
Yeah, Jacob, I actually think that your suggestion is brilliant. I really want to go to like a midnight viewing, you know, like they do with The Room or with
Rocky Horror.
Rocky Horror, like that type of thing where everyone is there and everybody's in on the joke and everybody goes and watches it. I feel like, and people can bring their fake vampire teeth or whatever. I feel like it would just be such an amazing experience.
What do we have to
We should host
right.
one.
Stay tuned for Cage Fest 2020.
Yeah,
brought
exactly.
to you by Wisecrack.
Right. Nick Cage for president 2020.
I think we got a voicemail from Ryan. He wanted to give us his two cents on this movie. Let's play that.
Here's Ryan.
What up, guys? It's Ryan. I hear that you guys are talking about the fucking classic movie Vampire's Kiss today. Damn it. I wish I could be there. I know I said last week that I really don't like movies about people going in delusional mental states, but this is one of those where they do it right, because you got to have someone like Nicolas Cage at the helm, basically, is the golden rule. What's there not to say about Nick Cage's acting? Some people don't like Nick Cage's acting or like what he's going for, but this is exactly what I go to the movies for, is to see people put it all out there on the line like him and show me something I've never seen before and show fucking emotions, every single one of the human emotions, especially yelling. And anyway,
the best emotion.
I just really enjoy it. This is the movie that my conspiracy theory is that American Psycho, all the people behind that movie, just Bret Easton Ellis just watched Vampire's Kiss a bunch of times. And then wrote that book. I'm going to go, but if you like this movie, go see Secretary too. There's kind of some similarities between James Spader and Secretary in this movie. Anyway, love you guys and love Vampire's Kiss and love Nick Cage. So psyched for Nick Cage Month. Peace,
Woo!
Baby.
Hell yeah.
Thanks, man. Jared, I have a request. You can say no.
Yeah.
I kind of just want to run through my favorite things from the director's commentary.
Oh, go for it.
All right.
Rattle it off, baby.
So Hemsdale, which I think is the marketing company, didn't understand the movie, according to the Bierman. They also cut it down dramatically, and Nick Cage thinks some of his best work ever was lost.
Oh, no.
Can you imagine if we can find that? It's got to
be
somewhere.
Oh, so we don't watch the director's cut, we don't watch like the original cut or the longer cut or whatever.
I don't think the original cut exists.
There are some scenes in the director's cut where they're like, oh, I think this got cut, but I don't know if that means all of it. But there was a couple scenes Nick Cage is like, I hadn't seen it. Also, everyone who loves this movie should watch the trailer to give you an idea of how they didn't understand it, because it's like a man just trying to find love in all the wrong places.
Oh, I love that.
So Cage was doing the voice of his father, who is a professor of comparative literature, who tried to speak with distinction at some point. I think we've already talked about that a little bit.
Oh,
George Decay.
Yeah. The dailies, people tried to stop the accent and the director didn't notice at first.
What do you mean people?
Like
producers?
The other producers?
The people watching the dailies, the producers, everyone involved was like, you need to make him stop this. And the director didn't notice and said it was fine. Probably one of my best bits is that Nick Cage was really into method acting at the same time as like exploring this expressionism, and he wanted a real bat because that's what real method actors do. And him and the director kept fighting about it, and at one point Nick Cage sent out his assistant to go find a live bat for the scene. And the director finally persuaded him, like some kind of petulant child, that he can't do the bat because if the bat bit him, he would die. And Nick Cage was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
I like the pigeon part, too. Although there was definitely no animal cruelty kind of mentions in this, I guess, in 1988.
Yeah, Nick Cage is kind of proud that he caught a pigeon, and the director in the commentary surprised him. He's like, oh, no, they were all drugged. Like, you can't catch an actual pigeon.
He thought it was his acting superpowers. And the cockroach.
Yeah, he actually ate a cockroach. There was an earlier scene, I don't exactly remember what's happening, but Nick Cage, I think the director wanted him to move in a certain way or move over. And Nick Cage was like, no, I need to be standing still right here to do this scene. And the director was really pissed off, and it caused it to take 10 times as long as it normally would. So Nick Cage, also being into method acting, the next day of shooting, wanted to do this cockroach scene. He wanted to eat a real cockroach, which he referred to as a business decision. He's like, it's like the bus blowing up in Speed, but you don't have to spend all this money on special effects. You know, it has the same effect. That's why he thought I've cockroach. The director made him do it twice, but still used the first cut.
Yeah, he's like, this is like a $2 million special effects kind of production,
right,
or performance.
Because people in the audience will react the
shocked,
same.
Yeah.
They'll be shocked. Very interesting. Very cool. All right, is that it?
Let me just keep looking. Oh, the scene after he rapes Alva, he stuck his fingers down his throat to make his eyes water. And make him seem more emotional. That's the boo-hoo scene, which I thought was interesting. He said that's an old actor's trick.
Yes, it is. The interesting thing, though, is in that bit right there, the director makes a remark that somehow that there was a joke in the rape scene and that people didn't get the joke. What is he referring to? Because I didn't get the joke.
A joke? I saw that it was that he didn't like that they were using blanks on camera, or they're using a prop gun.
Well, that was Nick Cage, but the director is saying that during the rape scene that they're like, people just thought it was a straightforward rape scene, but it's actually a joke and people just didn't get the joke.
I think when Nick Cage like laps his tongue at her, he does say it's so horrifying it's almost humorous. Maybe he means that.
Okay.
My next favorite thing from director's commentary is on day one of shooting, Nick Cage showed up with a pencil mustache drawn on and he wanted the character to have one. And then my favorite thing about the director's commentary is there's very much like a parent and a child dynamic of the parent just being like, no, you can't do that, and making up bullshit reasons of why he can't do that. So the director's like, no. In the scene where you have the vampire's teeth, the mustache is going to conflict and it's going to be confusing on the eye, so you can't have it. And Nick Cage is like, yeah, that's a good idea. I guess I'll drop the pencil mustache.
Yeah, as a director, you have to be like a parent. Like, you have to sort of just like, what's it going to take to get through to you, Nick Cage?
All right, cool. Well, we're going to go ahead and head into the mailbag. We're going to start with our voicemails. Once again, if you want to send us any comments, questions, jokes, whatever you want, 213-534-8807. Let's go ahead and see what we got.
We've got some voicemails from folks, a lot of voicemails about Bandersnatch, which we covered last week, and then we got Kyle, who called in about the Avengers. So let's start with some Bandersnatch stuff, and we can hop around. Jared, you let me know how many you want to go into. Let's start with Chris here.
Hi. My name is Chris. I'm from California, but I was just watching your Show Me the Meaning episode on Bandersnatch, and I thought it was really interesting about, I think it was Austin's comments about the way in which the show really makes you like look back at your own life, and it gets even more meta in the sense of like, oh, what if we're not being controlled on our own? Like, everything else is controlling us. I think it's interesting, and I thought the same thing when I originally watched, but I just wanted to note that in my opinion, like, the logic, like, it doesn't go anywhere. Like, you get super worked up about it, but like, if that is the case, then it becomes irrelevant because nothing you do matters. So, like, the only way to exercise that is to do something that Stefan did and, like, do some fucking nuts and just see if you could do it or if you would die or what goes on. But I don't think it's, like, worth getting caught up over. Additionally, and I'm surprised you guys didn't make this reference in your analysis, it made me really think a lot about the game Roy in Rick and Morty, when Morty gets the opportunity to live out this entire guy's other life. So I think in that context makes the conversation even more interesting is if you think like Morty, the way he experienced the game, he thought he was Roy. Like they needed to like reorient himself, him with his own like reality for a moment. So what if that's kind of like things are? So to concede Austin's point, like, hey, what if like we are being controlled by some other entity somewhere that is not currently us technically in this body, but maybe we just are that entity and we don't even understand that we're in this game because we're so thoroughly connected. I just thought it was an interesting point to make, and I thought a Rick and Morty reference was worth it. Thanks for taking it.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. So the first part he mentions, I think he's talking about at the end, or if you get the good ending, or what I consider the good ending, Stefan says, I just stopped worrying about the giving people free will and I just stripped it all out. Is that what he's saying in terms of why you shouldn't just dwell on it too much? Because ultimately it's his decision to not worry about free will that allows him to complete the game and for the game to be good. Is that what he's getting at? Is that what you guys got?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think too, it just has to do with the idea, if we are really determined, and if it could somehow be like scientifically verified without a shadow of a doubt, and everyone came to a consensus that yes, we are just biologically determined, and all of this, these notions of freedom are just illusory, then fuck it. Then you can just do whatever you want. And that's why the author of Bandersnatch was like, fuck it, I'm just going to cut the head off of my wife, and Stefan could just go and do whatever the fuck he wants to. I think that was kind of what he was saying, is that if that were the case, but you still had this illusion of freedom, then it doesn't fucking matter. Any choice that you make really has no consequence. Which goes to what Colin is saying on the balcony when they're all high, and he says that the choices that we make in this individual universe don't individually matter. They only matter insofar as they like lead towards that greater whole. But if the whole thing is determined, then your individual choices are going to simply serve that whole anyway. So it really doesn't fucking matter. So just throw yourself over the cliff, because it really is inconsequential.
I really love the paradoxical nature of that statement. If everything is determined, then fuck it. We can just do whatever we want.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the great paradox of of Oedipus, right? Like, was he determined to do it, or did he do it and then somehow it just kind of like led to it? Like, what is that relationship? I mean, you find that in religion too. If God is sovereign and everything is planned, then how do you have free will? And people have tried to reconcile it through stuff like compatibilism, which are philosophical ideas of trying to figure out how to reconcile free will with determinism. It is a paradox.
Cool. What do we got next?
We've got more Bandersnatch. Let me actually break it up real quick. Here's Kyle talking about the Avengers and allegory.
Hi, Show Me the Meaning crew. I left a message earlier, but I wanted to make it shorter so it could get on the air.
Thank you.
Kyle, longtime listener here, just rewatched Avengers Infinity War. Unlike you guys, I like this movie, and I feel like it's because they made a bold allegory for their villain. So, like, Thanos represents God the Father. A few examples are when the very first of the beginning of the movie opens, the very first words are a sermon from his preacher. Loki utters words to him before he dies. You'll never be one of us, a god. So the religious thing keeps coming up, and I feel like it's most poignant when he has to sacrifice his most beloved child for the salvation of all of us. I think it gets really interesting when you look into Christian doctrines that say God the Father isn't all-powerful but is limited by greater laws of the universe. And I feel like that really addresses the biggest complaint about the movie. Why didn't he just create more resources? Simply, he just didn't have the power to. So you can see that in Mormonism and other kind of transhumanism-type Christianity. Love to hear your thoughts. Thanks.
I like the movie. I don't dislike them. I mean, it's, you know, I think a lot of people with the Avengers, it's you either are so ecstatically in love with it that you can't say anything critical about it, or you just... you like it, but, you know, it's not fucking perfect. But anyway, that's really interesting. I have not seen it since theaters. I don't really remember thinking a lot about any kind of theological metaphors going on. But how did that ring to you, Austin?
I mean, I'm always down for thinking things in terms of theological or philosophical metaphors. Who's the son that he sacrifices?
Well, it's his daughter, Gamora.
Oh, daughter, Gamora. Okay, yeah. So he has to sacrifice Gamora in order to save the world. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, so from an Orthodox perspective, that would be problematic because God isn't shoehorned into having to sacrifice Jesus. And so there, I mean, I guess he could be, like he said, I don't know what he meant by transhumanist interpretations of Christianity, but like the idea that there are certain forms of Christianity that would say that there are like natural laws that exist outside of God, or not that exist outside of God, but that God works within sort of the reality of the world that God has created himself, that God can't violate God's own nature, right? So like God, you know, the whole thing, can God make a rock that's so big that God can't lift it? Or can God sin? No, God can't sin. So God can't do anything because there are restraints, but those restraints are the restraints that are the characteristic of the very nature of God's self, and therefore the universe that God has created is also subject to those things. So, I mean, I guess there's something to that he couldn't create more resources because the universe that he's created is essentially like a resource of scarcity or something like that. I mean, I guess there is something interesting there. I hadn't thought about that before, but when he was talking about it, the light bulbs were going off in the brain. I do find that interesting. And this has to do with like in theology is God's will supreme. So certain Protestant, particularly, interpretations of Christianity say that God's will is supreme. So God wills things first. And then there are other sort of interpretations that would try to say that, well, God's will isn't ultimately the most supreme thing, but it's something else. So how do we understand the nature of God? How do we understand the nature of the universe that God has created? And then how do we understand how God works within that? Are things the way they are because God has willed them to be that way? And is his will separate from his nature? Or is his nature preeminent? And then it's his will that sort of comes after that, that is following based on his nature. So that could be something that kind of that seemed to kind of be what he was talking about.
Definitely be interested to see if they lean into this more in the next movie.
Reminder on the voicemail number, if you want to leave us a voicemail. Do you remember the number?
213-534-8807.
That's it, I guess. So it's in the description.
So. I think so.
So if you want to leave us a voicemail for Nick Cage Month or for Vampire's Kiss, that's how you do it. I've got a couple more voicemails from for Bandersnatch. I'm going to dive into those.
Sure.
All right, here's one from Connor.
Hey, this is Connor, and I just am calling in regards to the Black Mirror Bandersnatch episode. I just had a thought about the discussion about whether, you know, we as people are controlled in the same way that main character of Bandersnatch is. Are we just pawns? Are we just characters that someone else controls? And it got me thinking, and I figured, at least to how I think about it, that, you know, if that is the case, if we're controlled by something more, something that we're not aware of, in a sense, that makes them us. You know, if someone else is controlling me, for example, like, I am, in a sense, them. And so I essentially become an extension of them, and they become, in the retroactive, well, not retroactive, but you know what I mean? I become an extension of them, and they become an extension of myself. And so we're not two different things, one controlling the other. I'm just them. I don't know if that makes sense, but, yeah, basically that's my thoughts. Maybe someone, one of you can extrapolate what I mean and expand on it. Thanks.
You can think of it like you're playing StarCraft or any game, or you know, chess. We are the pawn. We are the extension of their army, or we are the extension of their decisions.
Yeah, that's why the study of ludology, which is kind of choice and narrative, or the study of gaming, is so fascinating. And how we're actually thinking about doing a video about how this generation of gaming is very much about kind of open world, and the open world has been done in a lot of different ways. And I think the different ways that it's been tackled has allowed for the narrative to resonate on different levels. But as far as that's kind of the point I was going against in the Black Mirror episode. I think that you could do it both ways, which is why it's such a fascinating topic. It could be that, yes, by me controlling a character, I do identify with them more since it's my actions, but it could also be that, which I think the episode kind of points to by Stefan saying, you know, who are you, invisible puppet master? It does create this distance. But that's why I think the episode is so interesting. More so than the deterministic readings, I really think the ludology readings are super interesting.
Just to interject real quick, I was reading something really interesting, actually talking about the Roy episode of Rick and Morty, going back to that other voicemail. But to me, the question about like, oh, are we living in a simulation? Are we being controlled by someone else? That doesn't really interest me because I think you can't really prove it. But the point this person made is the real question is that we can actually never, what does it mean that we can never tell whether or not we're living in a simulation? And I think you could say that about Bandersnatch and all these other sort of simulation-based thought experiments is if we truly can't, let's say we're not, but we truly can't tell the difference. What does that mean for free will? What does that mean for agency, for choice, for morality and all that stuff? And I just think that's kind of an interesting way to frame it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
One last voice. Oh, sorry. Go for it. Awesome.
No, I was just going to say to kind of like particularly for that guy that left the voicemail, the last one, I don't remember what his name
Connor.
Was, but Connor. The what is it? Connor?
Mm-hmm.
Connor, if you want to look into Hegel, what you just described with the idea that like the people that are being controlled are just merely like extensions of the controller is very similar to this idea of like idealism that you might find of a Hegelian reading, which is the idea that you only know yourself in the objects that are like the objects or the products of your hand or the objects that are before you. Like you only know yourself insofar as you're being reflected back to yourself in them, or as you kind of are participating and co-constituting, like creating them alongside as you yourself are being created. And there is this like integral relationship between the two. So in that sense, the, what you're describing is kind of a way of looking at Hegelian idealism. You might be interested in looking at that further. Just the idea that you know yourself as you objectify yourself. Not objectify yourself like I'm objectifying myself as a woman and, you know, I'm using my sexuality. Not like that. But when you literally turn yourself into an object, when you do that, that's the only way you can know yourself. So you know yourself through the product of your hand, or you know yourself through the creature that you're creating or something like that, because then you're being reflected back to yourself. So might want to look into that.
Is the I know that there's like a Zen perception philosophy from the Zen perspective, they mention that you can't really know truth at all, but the only truth you can know is what you perceive and how you perceive it. So you could be assured that, like, the way that you are feeling temperature now, or the way that you are seeing an object, that is the only truth. Everything else you don't know. I'm not sure if you're kind of mentioning it in the same way in terms of that, like, you're just an object that can perceive certain things, and the way you perceive them, that's truth. Everything else is who knows. God knows, in terms of the Hegelian reading. We have one more voicemail from Aaron on Bandersnatch. I'm not sure if we have emails or anyone.
Yeah, I didn't write down any emails today, but we still are checking it. So if you want to send us an email at movies@wisecrack.co, we normally do read them on air, but I did not have a chance to compile them this morning.
It was an early morning, 5 a.m. wake up. So here's Aaron also on Bandersnatch.
Hey, Wisecrack, what's up? This is Aaron. I just got done listening to your Bandersnatch review. Thought it was really good. I love the whole Bandersnatch. It's amazing. But something I thought that you guys didn't cover that might have missed was just the whole nature of regret and wishing that you could redo your choices. You know, so like that first pass where, you know, your dream is that you're going to work with your idol, make a video game. And then he does it, and it sucks. It's terrible. It's horrible. And he's regretting his life. He's like, man, I wish I could do it over again. But guess what? You do it over again, and it's worse. You just lose your mind. You kill people. You just descend into madness. Same thing with, you know, all the hatred that he has for his dad. He blames his dad that for his mother's death. But then if you go back and you change it, you realize that either she dies anyways or you die with her. So actually his dad that he's been so angry and bitter at actually saved his life. If it wasn't for his dad hiding that bunny, he would have been dead. He would have been gone. So maybe, and you know, I've heard people before think about multiple reality as a kind of blanket of, well, you know, maybe there's a reality where I made better choices. Well, hey, maybe actually the life you're living, as terrible as it is and as many regrets as you have, maybe the life that you're living right now is actually the best option. So just want to see what you guys think about that. Love the show and hope you guys have a good one.
That's really interesting.
The only thing that does get better is that the game can be good. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
At least there's that.
Yeah, you can have to regret that and then go back and you get a better rating. Well, you know, it could just be the rating.
Somebody emailed us. I don't have the emails in front of me, so apologies if you're listening and I forgot your name. But somebody did email us and say, you know what? I actually think the good ending is when you die with your mother on the train. And I was like, well, I guess I can see how that might be a better ending than you chopping your father up and getting a good review.
It depends on what the goal is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Do you think we live in the best possible of all worlds, Alec?
I was just thinking about, I've been reading some Eugene Thacker, who's a real downer, so everyone knows. And he's a pessimist. And he says, you know, like pessimists are just like better optimists because they agree with optimists that we live in the best of all possible worlds, but realize that this is in fact the problem.
That was very well timed, thank you.
This is the best one, baby.
Speaking of which, last thing I want to end on is apparently Netflix is getting sued by the Choose Your Own Adventure.
Oh, I saw an article about that.
Yeah, because I think their lawyers are claiming that they're capitalizing off the nostalgia for their book series.
Well, Choose Your Own Adventure, I think, is like a copyrighted name for that genre, for that brand of book.
Or trademark name for that genre.
Which I didn't know. I thought, I mean, you can't trademark, you know, nonfiction.
But it's just the name, Choose Your Own Adventure. I think if somebody else did it and called Pick Your Own Path, you'd be in the clear.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't say Choose Your Own
Adventure.
Do
they use that in the marketing?
Well, it's like the Fine Brothers can't trademark React.
Right, because it's the actual act of reacting. But Choosing Your Own Adventure, I suppose, is a name where you might just say pick your next move. Or I don't know what the term would be.
Make a choice.
I think it's very similar.
I think it's a loose trademark.
Yeah, I think Netflix is going to crush that lawsuit.
I'm sure they'll be fine.
they'll just settle out of court. It'll be either way.
Yeah. All right, guys.
Show me the money!
So usually we do the emails, but it was an early morning this morning, so please still email us at movies@wisecrack.co. We are continuing with Nicolas Cage Month. We've got two more Nicolas Cage movies we're doing.
Definitely adaptation, I'm sure.
We're probably
going to
do adaptation, maybe Leaving Las Vegas, maybe...
Con Air, Face Off.
Maybe Con Air, maybe Face Off, maybe The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Who knows?
Let's try to get more than three people on the podcast.
Yeah, if you guys have any... wish list Nicolas Cage movies, send us an email. We haven't exactly decided which one we're doing next, but I think adaptation is definitely going to be
one of them. It's a safe bet. Yeah, put them in the comments on YouTube, send us an email, leave us a voicemail. Yeah, what Nick Cage craziness do you want us to dive into next?
And be on the lookout for our Nick Cage video on Saturday, which we're all very proud of and very excited for.
Yes.
And we're just feel so grateful to have Nick Cage in our lives right
Thank
now
you,
and
Nick
in our
Cage,
hearts.
His holiness.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any other Nick Cage. I mean, I'm just going to play off a little off the soundboard just as a wash over my day.
Digestive.
Bless us.
Yeah.
I'm a vampire. Kill me.
Vampire. I know I am. I'm a vampire. I can prove it. You got a gun. Fuck off me.
What's that from?
That is not from Vampire's
Kiss. No, it's not
Kiss,
Vampire's Kiss.
I don't know. Some other masterpiece, I'm sure.
But you guys get it.
That's all you have to do.
All right, okay. I think
all those are staying on the soundboard
forever.
By the way. So
we have to
be on the
soundboard.
Be on the lookout for more Nick Cage sound effects on Show Me the Meaning. Anyway, guys, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up for today. So thank you to my co-host for joining me. Where can we find you guys on the internet, Alec?
You can find me on Twitter @WisecrackAlec. I've been tweeting a lot of bad Marie Kondo jokes.
Mm. All right.
Oh, I like Marie
Austin.
Kondo.
Yeah, hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. Check out my philosophy podcast, Owls at Dawn, as well, if you would like.
Jacob?
You can find us at Wisecrack, @Wisecrack, Wisecrack_official on Instagram, YouTube.com/Wisecrack, or YouTube.com/AliensGuide.
Okay. All right, signing off for now, guys. Until next time, hooray for Nicolas Cage Month.
Yay, Nicky. I'm just going to play this off until we get cut off here.
What could be easier? It's all alphabetical. You just put it in the right file, according to alphabetical order. You know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z! Huh? That's all you have to do!